Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, a conversation with one of my favorite authors, Ann Patchett. Patchett's latest book is about two siblings, Danny and Maeve. Their mother abandons them as young children, never to return. The two grow up with their father and an evil stepmother, straight out of a fairy tale. It all takes place in an old Pennsylvania mansion, which their father purchased after a successful real estate career. But the display of wealth is also part of the reason their mother leaves. The new novel is titled The Dutch House. Ann Patchett joined me from her hometown in Nashville, where she also owns a bookstore, Parnassus. And there are so many interesting characters in this book, but let's talk about the house itself. Tell us about this gorgeous place.
Well, the Dutch House is in a suburb outside of Philadelphia called Elkins Park, and it was built by the Van Hoobake family. And they were Dutch. They had come to this country and made a fortune off of cigarettes, built this giant mansion out in the country, and they died off. The house went back to the bank, and it was purchased by Cyril Conroy just after the end of the Second World War. He had made a lot of money in real estate and bought it as a surprise for his wife, Elna. And it's just a gorgeous, gorgeous, ridiculous house, three stories tall, endless gardens, very beautiful, full of careful, beautiful details. And when Cyril bought it, he bought it with everything in the house. So all of the furniture, all of the painting, all of their clothes, everything's there. And they just move into this life.
And he never asked his wife. He never talked to her about the house before he bought it. He just took her there.
Right. It was a big surprise. And as far as she knew, they were extremely poor, just like their friends were poor and their family was poor. And he had made money in real estate, hadn't told her about it. And when he had all the money saved up, he bought this house as a surprise. And it was, shall we say, not a happy surprise.
It was not a happy surprise. His wife, Elna, hates the house. She thinks it's way too fancy. And she eventually abandons her husband and the two children.
Yes, because she's so perceives herself to be not only to be a poor person, but to be a servant of the poor. That's what her life is about. That's her life purpose, is to have nothing and to help those who have nothing. So to find herself suddenly in this ostentatious life where she has servants and everything is taken care of for her, she just loses her mind.
And did you create this house, or does it actually exist?
I created the house. There certainly are elements. I took little pieces from different houses that I have known in my life. I know someone who has a very, very grand estate who has that blue and gold dining room ceiling that I make fun of in the house. And I've been in a house that has the carved panels that I wound up putting in the downstairs powder room of the Dutch house. They're just lots and lots of elements. The window seat in Maeve's bedroom, which plays a big part, is what I wanted more than anything else when I was a little girl.
Huh.
I thought to have a big, deep window seat with draperies that you could pull shut would be the absolute best thing that could possibly happen. And so I gave that window seat to Maeve.
The enormity of the loss of their mother for Maeve and Danny is really extraordinary. And it just seems so difficult to think of a mother walking away from her children.
Yes. And I have to say, this is a book that I wrote twice, which I have never done before. I got to the end of this book and I had made some catastrophic mistakes in the storyline. Not small. Like I very early on, I went left when I was supposed to go right, and I followed a whole other trail. And let it suffice to say that in the original version, about 150 pages of the book took place in Calcutta.
Huh.
None of this book takes place in Calcutta.
I see.
When I went back and started the book again, I had a moment where I just sat down in my office and closed my eyes, and I thought of the mothers who live on my street. I went down the street and I thought of each of the women that I know who have young children, and I thought, what if she just left?
Oof.
Not because anything was wrong, not because she was in danger, not because her husband was beating her. What if, for some philosophical reason, she just left little Claire and Wynn? What if she just left little Fair and Jack? You know, I'm thinking of all the children on the street. And that's what I hadn't done the first time I wrote the book. And it made an enormous difference, because the fact is you can't leave your children for philosophical reasons and have it all be okay.
And it certainly is not okay when their father meets another woman. And I'd really like you to read this for us, the first time that Danny and Maeve set eyes on Andrea. Would you read that part for us?
I will always believe that Andrea's face fell for an instant when she looked at Maeve and me. Even if my father hadn't mentioned his children, she would have known he had them. Everyone in Elkins Park knew what went on in the Dutch house. Maybe she thought we would stay upstairs. She came to see the house, after all, not the children. Or maybe the look on Andrea's face was just for Maeve, who, at 15 and in her tennis shoes, was already a head taller than Andrea in her heels. Maeve had been inclined to slouch when it first became apparent that she was going to be taller than all the other girls in her class and most of the boys, and our father was relentless in his correction of her posture. Head up, shoulders back might as well have been her name. For years he thumped her between the shoulder blades with the flat of his palm whenever he passed her in a room, the unintended consequence of which was that Maeve now stood like a soldier in the Queen's court, or like the Queen herself. Even I could see how she might have been intimidating. Her height, the shining wall of black hair, the way she would lower her eyes to look at a person rather than bend her neck. But at 8, I was still comfortably smaller than the woman who our father would later marry. I held out my hand to shake her little hand and said my name, then Maeve did the same. Though the story will be remembered that Maeve and Andrea were at odds right from the start, that wasn't true. Maeve was perfectly fair and polite when they met, and she remained fair and polite until doing so was no longer possible. "How do you do?" Maeve said, and Andrea replied that she was very well. Andrea was well. Of course she was. It had been Andrea's goal for years to get inside the house, to loop her arm through our father's arm when going up the wide stone steps and across the red-tiled terrace. She was the first woman our father had brought home since our mother left, though Maeve told me that he had had something going with our nanny for a while, an Irish girl named Fiona. "You think he was sleeping with Fluffy?" I asked her. Fluffy was what we called Fiona when we were children, partly because I had a hard time with the name Fiona, and partly because of the soft waves of red hair that fell down her back in a transfixing cloud. But Fluffy had hit me with a wooden spoon when I was 4 years old. I still have a small scar in the shape of a golf club beside my left eye. The mark of Fluffy, Maeve called it. Fluffy claimed she had been cooking a pot of applesauce when I startled her by grabbing her skirt. She said she was trying to get me away from the stove and had certainly never meant to hit me, though I think it would be hard to accidentally hit a child in the face with a spoon. The story was only interesting insofar as it was my first distinct memory of another person or the Dutch house or my own life. I didn't have a single memory of our mother, but I remembered Fluffy's spoon cracking into the side of my head. That was our father's other relationship, according to my sister, and she should know because if I was 4 when I got that scar, she was already 11.
We'll be back with more from Ann Patchett after a short break.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Now, the rest of my conversation with Ann Patchett. Her latest novel is titled The Dutch House. The enormity of the losses that these children face become somewhat muted because Danny, the narrator, is fiercely protected by Maeve, and their relationship continues right on through the book. Tell us more about Maeve.
Maeve is smart and ramrod straight and very direct and funny and, as you say, fiercely loyal and protective with her brother. She comes home after the father marries Andrea. She graduates from Barnard. She, you know, speaks French and goes skiing and has the life of a rich girl in New York. But she comes home to watch over her brother as he's graduating from high school. She takes a job working at Otterson's Frozen Vegetables in Jenkintown, Pennsylvania. And it's just a summer job that she's going to do, you know, while she's looking after her brother. But she stays. She stays at Otterson's for the rest of her life. She stays in Jenkintown. And she can't move past the past. Neither one of them can. Both Danny and Maeve go on to have good lives and a lot of happiness. But they can't get over the injustice of their past, and they get stuck there.
And, of course, Andrea, though she doesn't play an active role in the book, she is forever somehow the witch that was. She's quite a character, I must say.
And, you know, in some ways, I'm drawing on old fairy tale themes. At one point, Danny's wife says, "You and your sister are just Hansel and Gretel walking forever through the dark woods holding hands, and Andrea is forever the witch that sent them out into the dark woods."
Exactly.
And in a lot of ways, I hated to exploit that trope of the wicked stepmother, in large part because I have a stepmother who I love so much and has been such a wonderful person in my life. But I think that in other ways, this book was about my own fears being a stepmother. And I'm always afraid that I'll be a bad stepmother, that I'll be a wicked stepmother. Those fairy tales weigh very heavily on me. So I liked digging into the character of Andrea and her selfishness and the interest of herself and her own two daughters above anyone else.
But I wonder to what extent you may have had some similar experiences as a child in terms of having to adjust to sudden family changes.
Well, certainly I had to adjust to family changes when I was a child. My parents got divorced and married other people, but really all of those people were so nice to me. This is a story that I have heard versions of from many people, of coming from a wealthy family and then the fortunes turn and they are cast out or they lose everything. That certainly wasn't my story, but it's a common story. So many of my friends who read this book when I was finished with it said, "Were you writing about me? Were you thinking about me?" Because I think that even if this doesn't happen, so many of us feel that we were cast out in a certain way and that we can't get over that.
I wonder whether anyone said to you, "You know, this is a fabulous book, but I don't understand how, under any circumstances, a mother could leave her children."
No, no one said that to me. And I think that Elna is a character who is very good and very bad and very selfish and very selfless. And she manages to maintain all of those contradictory positions at the same time.
I mean, I want to know Elna. I want to understand her. I want to sit and talk with her because she is such a fascinating person who had the courage to leave what she knew was a life-killing situation.
Well, I'll tell you two historical figures that I thought a lot about when I was writing Elna. One was Dorothy Day, and the other was Siddhartha, the Buddha, who, of course, leaves not only his beautiful golden palace where he has everything and knows nothing of suffering and death, but he leaves his wife and his son to go forth into the world and suffer. And the difference is everybody thinks the Buddha is the greatest guy who ever lived. But if a woman does it, she is the devil.
Yeah, I was going to ask that very question. Had this been a father who had left, it would have been a totally different story.
Completely different story. And we would say how deep, how meaningful, how like Odysseus he was to go into the world and do the things that he must do. Why men go to war? You know, you have to leave your family to fight for the greater cause. And we all seem to understand and accept that. But it's very, very troubling when it's a woman who leaves her children.
And very difficult to forgive, especially for Danny. Talk about the fact that these two children grow up sitting in a car outside the house and remembering every single detail of their lives while they're smoking and exchanging cigarettes.
When I first started writing this book, the very first scene that I wrote was of Danny and Maeve sitting in the car outside the Dutch house smoking and talking about the past. And it went so well that I just kept coming back to it again and again. It seemed in a way that they were their truest selves in the isolation of that car. And also when they're together, even though they both have their lives and they grow up, they part, they do other things, but they just can't let go of the past. And putting them in that car just turned out to be a great tableau for me as a writer. No matter how old they are, no matter what happens, they come back. They, even if they've only got 15 minutes, and they're really busy, they're going to drive over and park in front of the house where they grew up and smoke cigarettes and talk about the past.
Tell me about Danny. He is an interesting narrator.
Danny is smart, charming, affable, handsome, well-liked by everyone, and completely oblivious to the fact that there is a team of women who have smoothed his path and made his life possible from the time he was born. Danny doesn't remember his mother. She left in a time before his memory begins, but he doesn't miss her. Why should he miss her? He has his sister. He has the housekeepers, Jocelyn and Sandy, who take care of him. Everyone adores Danny. He is absolutely the little prince. So he can grow up in this wonderful, charming way, but I get very irritated with Danny, exasperated with him, because he is so oblivious to all he has been given, which I think is something that happens sometimes with certain very privileged men.
It almost seems as though Danny has a more real relationship with Maeve than he can ever have with the woman who eventually becomes his wife.
Well, yes. Poor Celeste. Poor Celeste, his wife. Celeste is the speaker of truth, and she's annoying. She's annoying to Danny and Maeve. She's annoying to the reader because she's always there on the sidelines saying, this isn't natural. This isn't the way people are. You two need to get on with your life. You need to let go of the past. And they just sort of roll their eyes at Celeste and leave her behind. But in the end, I think that Celeste turns out to be right. She's sort of like Cassandra in mythology. She's the one who knows the truth and no one will believe her.
Tell us about Parnassus, your bookstore in Nashville. Do you think that your having opened that bookstore has somehow filtered out to the success of other independent bookstores, which seem to be on an upward growth pattern?
Well, first I want to say you are forever connected to the opening of Parnassus, because the first time I ever publicly said that I was opening a bookstore was on your show. And I will just always remember that moment with you. And we will have been open for 8 years in November. And yes, I think it's true. I, as an author opening a bookstore, got so much publicity and continue to get so much national and international publicity for this beautiful bookstore that I am not responsible for, because my terrific partner, Karen Hayes, does everything, and we have a wonderful staff, and the community of Nashville has supported us, and we've doubled in size. And I think that a lot of people who maybe wanted to start an independent bookstore looked at us and said, well, look, it's going well. And I'll tell you how well it's going, Diane. We found out that Amazon is opening a bricks and mortar bookstore across the street from us in Nashville. That's how you know you're successful, when they come to kill you.
Wow. How do you think that could affect the way you do business there in Nashville?
It will not affect the way we do business. I mean, unless it just makes us more grateful for the people who support their local independent bookstore and makes us love our customers and our readers all the more. I have received some amazing emails from people in town saying, we're with you all the way. You know, we're going to continue to support you. We're going to fight the fight. I got an email from a doctor that I very vaguely know who said, you know, I'm not going to shop at Whole Foods anymore because of this. Huh. And actually, it's not my dream. It's not what I want. But I think that the people who buy their books at Amazon are still going to buy them and will continue to buy them. I mean, I don't think that the actual physical Amazon store is going to throw us off too much. I may be wrong, but we'll see.
And Patchett, how great to talk with you.
How great to talk with you. I'm so glad you're doing this podcast. I missed you for a few minutes, and now you're back. And it's a beautiful thing.
And that's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Cliff Gallagher and Natalie Urib-Lifker. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.